Welcome to the War Report on Public Education. The future of education is an important concern for our time. Where it's heading, how it's evolving, and the influence corporate America has on its outcome. The War Report on Public Education provides critical news, analysis, and perspectives on the what, why, who, where, when, and how of both the new corporate state elites campaign, the Machiavellian agenda to destroy the nation's public education system, and the rising public resistance movement to defend and defeat this Machiavellian agenda. And now, here is our host, Dr. James Avington Miller, Jr.
Hello, everyone, and happy Mother's Day. This is the special show that everyone told me I shouldn't do on Mother's Day, but I decided that this would be the most appropriate day to do a show. And so, we are here, and we're going to hopefully celebrate Mother's Day for all the mothers around the world, and we're going to also celebrate in our appreciation for our teachers. Today, we have another guest host on the show. Some of you may already know her. She is Kathleen Gomez. She is the co-host of a show called Shadow Politics that's here on BBS. And Kathleen, rather than going through your litany of your background, which
yes,
is so extensive, I just want to call you in right now and say, first of all, happy Mother's Day to you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Miller, and I'm really excited to be on your show with you. You know, we've had you on Shadow Politics twice about, you know, one of my biggest concerns, education, so it's just a pleasure to come back and spend some more time with you.
Well, see, that I like that. That's why I invited her on, folks, because she always says things about me because I was on her show. And so, and she's a mother, and she's into politics, so this was like a perfect selection on my part to ask her to co-host this show. Kathleen, I'm hoping that we will get people calling in, as I announced last week about this show, that this is totally unscripted. And we're just going to sit back and enjoy appreciating our moms and moms across the globe, as well as appreciating our teachers. And if we don't get people to call in, you and I will just share stories with each other about our first teachers and some of our classroom teachers. So
sure.
With that as the background, do you want to start off talking about your first teacher? Your mom.
Yes. I had quite a few of them. I was lucky to have two great-grandmothers and a grandmother and my mother living in the same town. I grew up on a small town on the Mexican border. And my great-grandmother on my grandmother's side was a medicine woman. And I remember her house when I was young. I would go over there. It was full of plants. And everyone would be knocking on her door, you know, saying, oh, you know, I have a headache, or my joints are hurting me, and this and that. And she would always have, you know, concoction of plants, and would tell them how to, you know, eat herbs and all that. And she once told me, I mean, I remember she was also very mysterious, and she would always tell me things like, you know, if you're leaving town, look for a crow, because the crow means if you see him that you will return safely. So, you know, all even up to this day, I mean, in Douglas there were a lot of crows. In Manhattan, where I was living, it was very difficult to find a crow, but I always end up looking, because, you know, she was that kind of person that gave me that sense of myth. It was like mystery and these all these different myths, and she was so revered in her community for being able to help people. And then my other great grandmother was, you know, kind of the caretaker of all these generations, and I would always go by her house, and she'd be making tortillas, you know, the old way, where they would, you know, kind of grind the flour and then, you know, make it by hand. And she was just I remember her house was, you know, the adobe home with thick walls and ground dirt, and it was so clean and it was so warm in there. And my grandmother, who had come from Mexico, was always, you know, telling me how lucky I was to be an American and how lucky I was to be born in a time where women could probably become something other than just being, you know, a stay-at-home mom. She was very, very, I want to say, kind of futuristic in what she felt my future could be. And I was the first girl after about four or five boys. So she just put all this hope in me and, you know, wanted me to do so well. And then, of course, it was my mother. My mother was born in Missouri and married my father when he went to school in St. Louis. And he told her he was going to bring her to a small Mexican village where she would have to do her clothes down by the stream. But, you know, she said, that's okay. If that's where we're going, we're going. Of course, it wasn't that bad. It wasn't that, it was a modern little community. But I remember back in those days, you know, Anglos and Mexicans didn't mix. They didn't marry. And when my dad brought home this Anglo girl, because she was blue-eyed and, you know, light, very light skin, and she was American, it was a very no-no kind of thing. No one had done that before. And there was a lot of prejudiceness. And when I was very young, and I remember this to the day, a friend of mine had said to me that she didn't want to be around me because Mexicans were dirty and that they slept on, you know, the dirt floor. And so I remember being very affected, and I had gotten that a lot from my friends. And I went home and I was in tears, and I told my mom that I didn't want to be a dirty Mexican anymore. And she said, well, what do you mean? And I told her. And so she said, well, you know, do you love your grandfathers and your grandparents and your great-grandmothers and your father? Because they are Mexicans. And she goes, you have to be proud of who you are. She goes, if you're proud of who you are, if you're not proud of who you are, you will always be seeking something you can't have. She says, but if you embrace who you are, you'll always be proud and you'll always be strong. And so she talked to me a little bit how people were hateful and sometimes they didn't understand things, but that I should always be so proud of who I was. And she said later that I sat there and I said, I stopped crying and I said, you know what? I am proud. I am proud to be a Mexican and I'll always be Mexican. And ever since that time, I've always stood the ground that I am a Mexican American. Even though if you looked at me, you probably wouldn't be able to guess, besides my last name, that I was of that heritage. So I think through my great-grandmothers, my grandmother, my mother, I learned a real sense of who I was and the roots that I came from. And through my mom, learned just how proud I should be of who I am. And that carried me a long way because nowadays, you know, people don't think that there was any racial problems between really the Mexicans and I want to say the Anglos. And there was. There was a time I remember going with my family and we refused to be served because my father was Mexican, and kids not going to my birthdays because my father was Mexican. And so that sense of pride and of who I was and to be strong carried me throughout my life, to tell you the truth. So I will always be indebted to her being able to give me some sense of comfort. You know, I think I was about 3 or 4 when this happened, and I remember it to this day.
That is an incredible story, and as an African-American, I can totally relate to your experience and the lesson that your mother and grandmothers taught you, and it feeds right into one of the things that I wanted to ask anyone who calls in, and that is the lessons that they learn from their mothers, the grandmothers, even their other caregivers like nannies and et cetera, that help prepare them for life. So let me explain what I mean by this. We're talking about teacher appreciation, mm-hmm. and what teachers do for us. Many times, and if not most of the time, teachers don't get a chance to prepare us for life, per se. Whereas our parents, our mothers, in this case, many of their lessons that we learn are lessons for life, not just for a semester, not just for a year in a classroom or in a school. These are life lessons, and what you've just stated comes right dead to the center of the heart of the question that I was going to ask you later on in terms of your parents or your mother preparing you for life. That's a great story. Really.
Yeah, it did carry me because I was kind of the first hybrid or whatever you want to call me, because that just didn't happen. Mexicans and the Anglos, you know, the gringos as they used to call them, never would mix, not to dance, not to play in the park. And so, you know, it did help me. And, you know, it's funny. I remember going to school at a very well-known women's school in Missouri called Stevens College. And I had a Cuban teacher. And Cubans tend to think, among all the Hispanic and Latin cultures, that they speak Spanish the correct way. And everyone else, especially the Mexicans, are not that, you know, they're a little bit peasant-like. And I remember sitting in this classroom, and I was, what, maybe 18, and the professor said, well, Kathleen Gomez, shouldn't she be Conchita or Juanita? And I remember sitting there looking at him and thinking, I can't believe at this age that I'm hearing this from a professor in a school that is supposed to be known, you know, to actually train young women to be successful. And so I remember just feeling a little like that sting, you know, when you get insulted, and then hearing my mother, you know, just say, just, it does, you know, be proud of who you are because you come from a great line of people and never be ashamed of them and you'll find the strength. And I just, you know, I remember just looking at him and saying, you know, I don't understand what you mean by that. And I think I embarrassed him, but I, you know, throughout life, a lot of times I would go to places and think, well, this is all passing, you know. People don't have these kind of prejudices, but they still do to this day. And you're right. Those are the lessons that really, you know, help you stay strong and build your characters throughout life. And it's something I try and hope I do in my sons, even though these days are so much more trying, I think, in raising kids than you know, when we were young.
Kath, I'm smiling on my end of the phone here because you just reminded me of a life lesson that my mother taught me, and your example is right out of what I'm about to say. One of the early lessons that she taught me was, her phrase was, when you have your hand in the lion's mouth, you have to gently pull it out.
Which, yes.
When you're in situations like that and the odds are stacked against you, you have to be clever as to how you deal with it. That was a lesson that I learned from her, but I don't always follow.
Right, I know.
I was thinking, when you talked about your professor, I was thinking, like, I would have gotten in his face. But then you handle it much better than I would have. And then I thought about my mother's lesson telling me as a little boy, you know, when you have your hand in the lion's mouth, you can't just pull it out. You just have to be very gentle about it and ease it out, and et cetera, because the lion is so powerful, and da-da-da, I'm going to listen to him like, yeah. Get in my face.
And it's true, because it was the first day of class. It was the first class I had with this man for a whole semester. And I, you know, I wanted to, first I thought, I'm going to walk out. I'm going to stay at that, you know. And my mom would always, when these things would happen, she would say, just stay calm. Just remember who you are. Be proud of what you are. And, you know, don't take any prisoners in a way. Just, but be calm. Because, you know, I sometimes get so upset, and she says, no, just be calm.
I think your mother and my mother must have known each other. We have a caller, so let's bring our caller in. Caller, are you there?
Yes.
Hello?
Hello. Hi.
Hello, caller.
My name is Deborah.
Oh, okay. And what's your story, Deborah?
Well, I basically was so enthralled with Kathleen's story about when she was growing up, because I had this very similar. I happen to be a white person, Kathleen, but I grew up in a little town called Mountain View in the Bay Area, which is right next to Palo Alto, which is right next to Stanford University. But the Mexicans lived on the other side of the tracks, right? But I went to a Catholic school, and my best friend was a Mexican. Her name was Lupi Davila, and she taught me. She was not my mother, but she taught me so much about just a big family and about the family values and the food and the cousins and the grandparents and the wisdom that would happen in their home. And I just was enthralled by your story, Kathleen, and I just wanted to say thank you. And it reminded me a little bit of the writer Clarissa Pinkola Estes, who wrote Women Who Run with the Wolves. She tells a lot of these Mexican myths and whatnot, and they're just fascinating. And I just wanted to say thank you.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. You know, it was, you know, I must admit that the Mexican community was something that was, it was generations, you know, that was what was so great about it. There were always several generations, and it was all around the cooking and the mothers and the grandmothers and all the women, you know, played such important roles in shaping the men. You know, it was very interesting. I used to always say to my great grandmother, I said, "Well, yeah, well, why are the guys so machismo?" And she goes, "Ah, well, that's because of their fathers. That's one thing we can't seem to change." But it is. It's a very interesting background with my great grandmother being, you know, Yaqui Indian. And it was interesting because my other great grandmother had also been, I forgot the Indian tribe she was from, but she had actually been kidnapped by the Apaches because they lived down there and was a slave for many years until her family came and actually got her back. It's kind of amazing when you think of it that this history is so, that was, you know, maybe 80 years ago or something like that. But it's kind of funny to think about that. It's tragic, but her family did go back and rescue her from the Apaches. But I appreciate it.
Ladies, we have another caller, but before we go, I want everyone to know that the Deborah that you're listening to happens to be my Deborah. She is my muse, my friend, my mentor, and the person who produces our show, The War Report.
Thank you, Deborah, hello, Deborah.
Hello.
It's great to hear your voice.
Thank you. Thank you for your story.
I was somewhat taken aback when he said, Deborah's on the line. I'm going like, okay, Deborah's on the line. But anyway, Deborah, thank you very much for calling in and giving me a chance to hear some of your story. But more importantly, give me a chance to introduce you to the audience that we're building up as each show comes and goes. We also have another caller. And so, ladies, we're going to say goodbye to Deborah and then go to our next caller. Okay.
Hello?
Hello,
Dr. Miller.
Out there?
Oh, Senator Brown.
You will recognize this. You will recognize this.
I recognize his voice, all right.
First of all, I want to call in and because we all want to support your show. You know that, as Kathleen already said, you've been on our show and you just were a great guest, and we think that you have so much to offer the people of America. So we hope that your show gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger every week, because I think it's really an important show, and I think that you have a lot to add to the national conversation on education, which we're all concerned about these days. But I called in to talk about moms.
Kathleen and I are going to talk
about the politics.
Let me ask Kathleen to introduce you.
Okay.
Well, yes, this is Senator Michael Brown, who's what we call shadow senator for the D.C., Washington, D.C., which is actually struggling to become a state, struggling to have the rights that have been denied him, which is in our Constitution. And he's been a lifelong friend, and he is a great storyteller. And we're on at 4 o'clock on the same station on Sunday after Dr. Miller. And so I asked the senator if he would call in to talk about his mother, because he has some great stories to tell. And so thanks, Senator Brown, for calling in.
Yep. Well, first let me say that, much like Kathleen, I was lucky in that I was raised in a house with my grandmother, my mother and my older sister, all who took an active part in my life and taught me many, many things, not to mention teaching me that women make really great friends in life. I think a lot of men don't understand this, but women make really good friends. And Kathleen and I have been friends for more years than I can tell you. I'm the godfather to her oldest son, and she's the godmother of my youngest daughter. So we've had a lifelong friendship, and that making friends like Kathleen in my life, a lot of that comes from the fact that I was raised by women, and they taught me how loyal women are, how compassionate they are, how open and warm and giving they are. And if you're a man with half a brain, you have several women friends. They're great to have. Kathleen was one of my surrogate mothers. She's been telling me what to do for the past 20 years, even who to marry, right, Kathleen?
Yeah, exactly. Even who to marry.
The first time Kathleen met my wife, we were dating, and Kathleen looked at me and said, "You should marry this woman." So I did.
Yes.
And so far, it's worked out pretty well. We have three kids. But let me just tell you quickly, the thing I remember most about my mom, I lost my mom when I was 15 years old. My mom and dad both died when I was a teenager. But the thing I remember most, the thing that I think she taught me the most, was to be involved. My mother always saw herself as a mother. That's what she was. That was her identity. So if she was walking down the street and she saw a kid crying, she would intervene. She wouldn't walk by a child. She'd walk up and go, "What's the problem? What can I do? I'm a mother." You know, as if she had been, as if she had a badge from the federal government or something to intervene on with any child anywhere that had a problem. And you know, she worked her whole life in the school system, but her avocation was always children. She was an amateur actress, had a children's radio show. She worked in an elementary and a middle school. And, you know, she always involved herself. And she taught us that we should always involve ourselves. We should never just walk by a problem. We should never see a wrong somewhere and not try to help correct it. And I think that's what she gave me most in life. And I'll tell you, when she was a secretary in an inner city school, one day the gym teacher was bringing a student to the office to be reprimanded. And this was 40 years ago, more than 40 years ago. And the kid pulled out a knife and stabbed the gym teacher in the stomach. While everybody ran in several directions, my mother, who was in the office, stood up, walked out the door, said to the kid, "Are you crazy? You can't stab a teacher. Give me that knife." And the kid put the bloody knife in her hand. And then she said to the kid, "You walk in and sit down in that chair, mister. You're in a lot of trouble." And the kid walked in and he sat down. And, you know, while everybody else saw a criminal, what my mother saw was a child. She saw a child in distress, and she intervened. And the end of that story is that when it came to testifying against the kid in court, she didn't want to do it. We had to force her to do it because she couldn't bring herself to say anything bad about a kid, even a kid who had stabbed his teacher. But she taught us that you don't run when there's a problem. You stand up and you make sure you're counted. And, you know, today I spend my life working for the 635,000 people that live in the District of Columbia trying to stand up for them. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think it's from what my mother taught me. My brother and sister were exactly the same way. They always, my sister worked for Native Americans. My brother is president of a community college in the number one community college in America, actually, in a rural area that was depressed, and he came in and has created a great college. And so this, you know, this is what I remember most about my mother, that she was a doer, that she got involved, that she taught us to stand up and take a stand on things more than any one thing that she taught me. She also drove me crazy because she was my mother, of course. But
you have great stories about
her. She made me the person that I am today.
Tell us just one thing that she did that she, because you had so many funny stories about what your mother used to do. Can you share
well,
a crazy story?
You know, I mean, she was a mom, and she helped create the Little League, for example, in my hometown. But she didn't understand anything about sports. She had no concept of sports whatsoever. In fact, she once, my brother and I used to spar in the garage, and she once gave away a set of our boxing gloves because we had two sets. So we used to have to go to our college. He would wear the left one. He was left-handed, and I was right-handed. He would wear the left one, and I would wear the right one, and we would put our, you know, other arm behind her back. So, you know, we invented one-arm boxing because my mother really didn't understand that you needed two sets of gloves to make it work. But my favorite incident is that she had a purse that she used to carry that had everything in it. It was gigantic. We used to say that she carried spare car parts in her purse. But anyway, we were at a football game. My brother played college football, and he was coming off the field after he was a special teams player. He had just run back a kick, and he was coming off the field, and somebody said to my mother, "There's Paul." And my mother took the binoculars, said where, and we pointed them out, and she said, "Oh," and then all of a sudden she went, "Oh my gosh." And she reached in her purse and grabbed something, and she walked down. Now, this is a college football game with thousands of people. She walks down to the fence, and she finds the biggest guy I think I've ever seen, and she goes, "Yoo-hoo, honey," because anybody under 40 years old was honey to my mother. And he said, "Yes, ma'am." And she said, "Do you know Paul Brown?" And he went, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, do me a favor. Give him these Dixie cups from his mother and tell him I don't want him drinking out of that bottle with those other boys. Because it's not." And, of course, the guy said, "Yes, ma'am." And he ran over and he grabbed the Dixie cups from my mother. And then we had to explain to my mother why my brother wouldn't talk to her, because they were filling his locker with Dixie cups before the games, and they would get on the intercom before the game, and they'd go, "Paul Brown, Paul Brown, please come to the office. Your mommy's here." And, you know, my mother stood up at the dinner table and looked at me and said, "Do you mean to tell me that these boys are harassing him because his mother loves him?" And we were like, "Yeah. Of course they're harassed. That's what teenage boys do. They live for this." But she never quite understood that. And my brother, I think, finally healed after a few years. But you know, that's the way she was. She was just, you know, unabashed about her children and about anybody's children. You know, and she taught us that's the way we all should be, you know, that we all had a responsibility. She really didn't see her responsibility as a mother to end with her own children. She thought because she was a mother that she was responsible for all children everywhere, wherever they needed assistance. And, you know, I think that's true. I think if we all had that attitude, you know, I've seen lots of people look the other way when kids are in trouble, especially if they're in trouble and their own parents are there. But, you know, my mom taught us that everybody's responsible for, every adult is responsible, especially parents, for standing up for every child, because that's what every child needs and that's what every child deserves. And, you know, I still feel that way. I still get involved. You know, even when she was driving us crazy, she would do, you know, we always knew she loved us. We always knew she cared. We always knew she cared about all kids. So that was my mom, and I only had her for 15 years, but it was enough. She was.
Thank you, Mike.
Great.
Thank you very much for the story.
Well, thank you, Dr.
I learned
Miller,
something.
I learned something about you today, Mike.
I was never on the football. I could tell you even funnier stories about me and my mother in football, because I was the worst kid on the football team. And my mother always took umbrage at the fact that they didn't let me play much because I wasn't very good. Don't steal Kathleen from me, because I need her. And I'm going to go work on our show. But all of you folks out there listening, Dr. Miller has a lot of important things to say and a lot of knowledge to impart to all of us. So please continue to listen to his show.
Well, Mike, thank you for those good things that you said. And because of that, now I'm going to have to take back half of the bad things I've been saying about you.
Well, that's all right. Because you know what? Kathleen will fill in for you. She'll fill in the other half for you. All right, guys. You have a great show. And I'll talk to you soon, Kathleen.
All right. Thanks, Senator Brown.
All right.
Well, I'm going to tell a story right now about my mother. I've got many, like Mike, I have many stories to tell. One that I'm going to tell now is one that I hadn't even thought about when I was developing this show until this morning, maybe about an hour or so ago. When I was maybe about six or so, I had a neighbor who was a vacant lot, and he wanted to plant a garden there, grow corn, tomatoes, and et cetera. So he asked me to help him do this, and I did. And we planted this garden, and it grew, and it was fantastic. Well, my house was like Grand Central for everyone that my parents knew from their hometown that came up to Detroit. I'm born and raised in Detroit. They were from Southern Illinois. All of their brothers and sisters, anyone could come and stay with us and what have you. Well, my father's youngest sister was there. Another friend from their hometown was there, and there were several other people. These people were maybe 10, 12 years older than me, but they all didn't like me. They thought that I was a spoiled kid. I wasn't raised like them. I had some of the advantages that they never had, even though we were poor as church mice and et cetera. So once my folks went out to do something, my aunt, my father's sister, and another lady, and another guy, can't remember him right now, they did what they call boost me up to go out and steal an ear of corn from the garden. And I took the challenge, more or less. And I had watched all kinds of war movies. So I knew how to crawl on my stomach and try and duck and hide and et cetera, et cetera. I went out. I stole this ear of corn. I came back. I showed them the ear of corn. The minute my parents came back in, they showed my mother and father this ear of corn that I had stolen.
Oh, my gosh.
I was in trouble. I knew I was in big-time trouble. My mother grabbed me by the hand. She didn't spank me. She walked me over to the neighbor, was an older gentleman, and she made me give him the ear of corn that I had stolen and made me tell him that I had stolen it. And he looked at me, he almost cried, and I'm standing there, and he said to me, "You didn't have to steal. This was your garden just like it was my garden. Why did you do this?" And so my mother explained to him what had happened, and then she turned to me and she told me, "You never have to steal anything. You never have to lie about anything. We are here to do all these things that you need to help you grow up and et cetera." She gave me this lecture in front of this man, and as you said, Kathleen, to this day, I have never forgotten that lesson of humility,
mm-hmm.
lesson of being honest, lesson not to steal, lie, cheat anyone. And I built my life around one of the principles that I got from her on that particular lesson. I'm going to cut this short because we have another caller.
Okay.
We'll have the caller come in, please.
Hello?
Hello, caller? Hello?
Hi, yes.
Who are you?
I am Michelle.
Oh, and where are you calling from?
From Los Angeles.
Oh, okay. Tell us your story, that what you've learned from your mother as a, your or grandmother as your first teacher.
Well, just to kind of get a little bit current, I just completed my master's degree from UCLA here, and my journey started years ago, though, back in Chicago, where I grew up in one of the poorest communities in the city, actually. And but what was really important is that though we didn't have much, education was really emphasized as the key to get out of the situation that I was in, if I wanted to take advantage of it. And one of the things that my mother did when I was very young was she really pushed to, at the time, the schools were becoming magnet programs, you know, where they would bus children out of maybe the school that they were at, but, you know, send them to another public school. But the schools were designed to, mix the schools with a variety of different races from all over the city. And so she really pushed for me to get into one of those schools, and I started in third grade, and that was really the beginning for me, because the schools that I was attending in my neighborhood, they just, you know, they were okay, but they didn't meet the needs that my mother or what she had for me. And so it was kind of odd, because most of my friends went to the schools right in the neighborhood. They didn't get on a bus, and so I felt really odd doing so, but it actually turned out to be the best thing ever. And what it did was it afforded me the opportunity to, one, she couldn't afford private schools or anything like that, but we were still in a public school, but it was public schools that were designed to, you know, improve or to be better. And it just opened up my world, because I was able to be around children from all over the city, from different backgrounds and economic situations. It was very diverse, not just with race, but also economics, which made it really nice. And it's really kind of sad, because I don't see a lot of schools like that anymore. And I remember thinking at the time it was really the best experience. The teachers were also reflective of that. So for me, what she showed me was, you know, at this very young age with very limited resources, to push to get the best education that you could get, and that it was possible to get a great one that was free, you know, that was, well, you know, taxpayer paid, but at least we didn't pay out of pocket. We didn't have the money to do so. So that was really important to me, because when I later in life decided to move to LA and go to UCLA, it was with that same motivation that I could, you know, go out into the world and pursue what I desired for myself, which was to get this higher education, but also, you know, still be able to do it in a way that was much more affordable. Even though, you know, I had to move to do so, it was still worth it. And then the other thing is my mother really emphasized reading, which I feel like that's something that seems to be lacking a lot today also, with the emphasis on, and I get technology and all of that, but just the simplicity of reading. And one of the things that she would do is she would, to punish me, she would not let me read, which really was like reverse psychology, and it made me want to read, and I would beg to read, and she would, and it actually had worked, and I ended up later using that same thing with my children, and they both love to read today. And I mean, when I say read, I mean physical books, you know, with actual covers and pages. And the other ways to read are fine, but it's still something about having a book and folding it back and being able to, you know, dog ear the page or highlight a section that you love and come back to it. So, that's kind of where I am and where I started. I don't know if, you know, what else to say.
Well, that's a great story. And my mother was that way also. My mother, throughout my life, we always had, and I think it was mostly for her, like a timeout. And, you know, my father would be at work, and it'd be in the afternoon after lunch that she cleaned up. Then we were to have an hour and a half of quiet time, and she had books everywhere. And one of the things was she was like, read. You know, you can get lost. You can go anywhere you want to go, and you can just you know, lose yourself in this book. And it was amazing because to this day, I'm like you. I like the hard book. I like the smell of the, you know, the paper, the pages, and
yeah.
opening up and just feeling it in your hand. And yes, that's what I've also always read to my kids. And it does make, when mothers do that, it makes such an impact on them, on their children.
Yeah. Yeah, because it was interesting as my son, who's now 10, he said to me maybe about 2 years ago that he didn't like to read. But I knew that that's common for boys in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I decided to do was to fight that and say, you know what, we just have to find books that you would love to read. And so his dad and I, my husband, we started looking at, you know, one, trying to get a sense for what he really liked, which he likes science, so we thought, oh, maybe science fiction. And so we introduced him to book series, and I went out and I would buy, once again, the hard copies of books, and we would buy him just whole sets. And I started with the Roald Dahl series of books and Matilda and all of those, and he loved them. He read them all, and then so that began for him a love of books. And just to share recently, the other day I couldn't find him. I didn't know where he was, and I was fussing, and I was like, where are you? And I go in his room, and he's actually under the covers reading his new book, and he was just so absorbed in the book he didn't answer me. And I was just so touched. I was like, yes. And I feel like in 2 years I went from I don't like to read to, you know, he's hiding out to read. And that just meant so much to me, because on top of all the other things that he does, I really want that to be a part of, you know, who he is. And I see the connection between those who read and also later your writing skills and your ability to communicate with others. And then you just have this profound sense of knowledge in your head from reading all of these wonderful books. And that means a lot to me as well.
And your vocabulary, well, too, you know. Your vocabulary from when you read, it really enhances the kids, because most kids don't have very much of a vocabulary these days.
Oh, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I went to pick him up from school, and a teacher told me a story that she was in the classroom talking with him, and another teacher came in, and he was shocked. He thought that she was talking to an adult, and he could not believe that she was talking to a kid. He said, because from the other room, the conversation was so advanced, the vocabulary was so advanced, and she was saying, yeah, his vocabulary is just awesome. And it is, and he really tries to use the words that he learns, which is really cute, because every now and then he'll drop one of them. And I'm like, oh, wow, that's a new word. He's like, yeah, I learned it in this book, and so I thought I'd practice and use it a little bit. So that's fun, too, because our conversations have improved drastically. Because, you know, because he could be very much, you know, the one answer. You know, it's like,
yes.
Hey, how's it going? Fine. And it's like, now he'll say, oh, you know, we did this in school and blah, 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 and my teacher, you know, he was, and so it's, so I see that as well.
Well, ladies, I see the two of you have hit it off very well.
Yeah,
how old is your son?
Yeah,
Michelle,
it was brought to my
son?
Memory, the fact that my mother had been such a advocate for reading, and it's, you know, it's amazing when you talk to other people how you remember the things that your mother's done for you.
Yeah, definitely. Yes, I'm just really grateful for that, because I feel like the thing that my mother really instilled in me, it's now passed on to my children as well. And to really see that my son, who was resistant to it, which, you know, I was like, oh, you know, but at least I knew. I'm like, no, just find what he loves to read. And now his reading has expanded, you know, beyond just sci-fi. I mean, he reads, you know, anything he wants to read. I'm like, oh, read that. Okay, fine, read that. You know, I just encourage reading, period. And I've even tried to get him to read a few magazines. He's not quite gotten into magazines yet, maybe just because he hasn't found the ones that he really likes. But I'm hoping, you know, to just expand it so that he'll just read everything.
Well, it sounds like you're a great mom too. So
happy Mother's Day to you. And say, oh, I saw this on the internet, and I'm now teaching him how to verify internet information. And he's always so shocked when he finds information that's not true. But now he's learning how to do the research.
Well, ladies, may I interrupt the love fest for a moment?
Yes, of course.
Yes.
Great story, Michelle. How old is your son?
He's 10.
He's 10?
Yeah,
oh,
he's 10. He'll be 11 actually in June, but he's 10.
Yeah, he's at that great age where he's still lovable, teachable, and doesn't have attitude per se. That'll change.
Yeah, just wait till 14.
Lay that out there. There will change. But, Michelle, thank you very much because you really brought in the two things of today's show, your experience with your mother and how your mother basically was your first teacher in terms of getting you to understand the importance of learning to read, get a good education. And then you took us to where you are as your child's first teacher. And then you integrated that with your teacher, your son's school teacher. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You did us proud.
Okay, well, thank you.
Okay.
Hi. Right.
Well,
it's been a great show so far, Scope.
Well, thank
good
you.
Luck to you.
And I just want to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers listening and everyone.
Thank
Sound
you.
Like you
yes.
want to have your own show. Sound like you want to have your own show.
No,
okay, voice
thank you.
For it.
Thank you very much. Well, Kathleen, it's
yes.
back to you and I. I have another story that I want to tell. And this story, I was 4 years old. And these are, you know, the stories that you will never forget.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how old you are, you will always remember this. Well, my mother was a young teenage mother. She and my father got married when she was 17, had me towards the end of her being 17. She was just 10 days away from her 18th birthday. And one of the things that she wanted was to have me get a good education because she had only gone to, I think, the 7th, 8th grade, which was a lot for women in her time. My father never went to school a single day in his life, never learned to read or write. So education was very important for the both of them. So when I was about 4, my mother and father went downtown to the big department store, and they bought every school supply that the sales clerk told them the teachers were using in kindergarten, first grade. So my mother buys all of this stuff, and then she starts teaching me. I mean, she was literally my first teacher as well as my mother. And every night we would get in the bed. My father worked nights, and so she would start teaching me my, what she called my letters and my numbers, mm-hmm. my ABCs and how to count. And at the beginning, it was fun. And I was learning all these things and what have you. But after a while, I didn't want to do it anymore, and it got very boring. So using one of Mike's story about football, I would start, she would have me count, and when I didn't want to do it anymore, I would go ballistic on her. Instead of saying 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I would go 36, 37, 49, 100. I was just making up stuff as if I was a quarterback calling out plays from the line of scrimmage. I would do the same thing with the alphabet, and at some point, she would break down and start to cry. One night, as I said earlier, our house was Grand Central. Everybody's family lived with us. One of her older brothers was living with us at the time. This particular night, he came in, and she was crying. And he stood on the side of the bed, and he wanted to know why she was crying, because he was very protective of his baby sister. She told him how I was basically acting out, acting up. What I'm about to describe to you actually happened. I'm going to describe it to you in slow time. This happened in real time. My uncle reached over with, I think, his left hand. He snatched me from out of the bed. While he was snatching me from the bed, with his right hand, he was unbuckling his belt. Fluid motion, unbuckled it, pulled the belt off around his waist, and by the time he had me standing on the floor, he was spanking my butt. I was crying. My mother didn't know what to do. Then he put me back in bed and told me, boy, you better da-da-da-da-da. And sure enough, I went back to A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, all the way through to 100. And I did that the whole time he was home. He came home from work, getting dressed to go out. And the minute he left out, I went back to 47, 56, A, F, G, C, 2, J, anything and everything to frustrate her, to get my revenge. And every night, this would happen again. He would come home, she was crying, and he would spank me, right?
Uh-huh.
And so finally, I learned to hear him and figure out, I didn't know how to tell time or anything, but figure out what time this guy was coming home. And when I was listening for him hitting that first step and then opening the door, and before that, I was all over the map, the A, B, Z, Z, what have you. And the minute he stepped in, I would go A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, through the alphabet, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way to 100. And I would do that the entire time he was home until he left. And my mother, she caught on to it and straightened me out and taught me as a four-year-old, everything that kindergarten teachers teach, everything that first grade teachers teach. And as a result, and all of those spankings that I got, when I got into kindergarten, I'm old enough that when, instead of giving the standardized test that they give now, they gave intelligence tests, straight-out intelligence tests, to prove that blacks were inferior to whites, and et cetera. When my kindergarten teacher gave me the test, she didn't know what had happened. She went over to, I was in morning kindergarten, she went over to the afternoon kindergarten teacher and talked to her. That teacher came over, and she gave me another test for the same purpose, but another test. After the results, they got together. They didn't know what was going on. They went and got the first grade teacher. She gave me a test. Bottom line was, I crushed every single test that they gave.
Mm-hmm.
They had never seen any black child or white child crush tests the way I did as a kindergartner and as a would have been first grader. They were so amazed by this that they wanted to put me in the first grade or possibly even the second grade, and I had just turned 5 years old. And my mother said, no way that she would allow that. And it was all because my mother was literally my first teacher, and she would continue to work with me all the way through to junior high. Spelling tests, history lessons, English lessons, handwriting, you name it. She was both literally and figuratively my first teacher, and I had the spankings to prove that. Thanks to my uncle.
That's a great story. That is a great story.
That is a true story. And the details that I gave you are as I remember them. And it fits right into what we're talking about in terms of this was a life lesson this woman was giving me. The importance of education, the importance of studying and learning my lessons, and et cetera. And you already know, I became a teacher.
That's right.
Maybe because of her. Really because of her. It's a longer story in terms of what she wanted me to be and how that came about. But I articulated what she wanted me to be. Instead of being a medical doctor, I became a PhD, a university professor. I did some public school teaching, but basically I was a university professor. And it was all my mother. And that fits into what I said earlier in terms of life lessons that we get from our mothers. Folks, our time is running out. I want to say a couple of things before our time completely vanishes. We have talked about the stories that, you know, we've gotten from our mothers and hopefully the gifts that we were able to give our mothers. But there are so many other things that we need to give our mothers all around the world that would make their lives as mothers much more pleasurable. And that is, for example, we need, as a country, we need to raise our federal minimum wage. We need to stop thinking minimum wage and start thinking about living wages and raise it to $15 to $17 an hour with full benefits for both part-time and full-time women who are working. We know that women, businesses pay them less for doing the same work. We need to stop that. We need to make sure that women who work get paid equal pay for equal work. And to just let you know, today, women make up two-thirds of all the minimum wage workers in our country, two-thirds. And that women make up 60% of our primary or breadwinners in all our households. If we were to change nationally, at the state level, at the city level, our approach from minimum wage to a living wage, we would affect 47 million working moms. We would bring them into middle class, out of poverty, and we would make life for them a hell of a lot better than it is. And this would be one incredible Mother's Day present for all moms for all time.
That's correct.
We need to ensure equal work, as I said before, equal pay for equal work. We need to expand access to paid sick and family leave for our mothers. We need to expand access to affordable, high-quality preschool. And we need to ensure reproductive rights for all women. If we could do one or all of these would be everlasting, universal, great Mother's Day gifts.
Yes, they would be.
I think you would agree with that, representing the moms of the world.
Yes.
And with that.
and you know, I would ask the audience to maybe listen to Shadow Politics, because we are going to speak about the politics that affect all moms, all women, and that the fact that the ERA has not yet been ratified, that to me is always something that I'm still quite amazed at, that we haven't done that one thing for women.
We have to stop time.
All right.
Happy Mother's Day to all moms everywhere.
Yes, thank you.
Goodbye.
Happy Mother's Day.
Have a great Mother's Day. Bye.
Join us again next time as we explore and become aware of the most pressing problem of our time, education, corporate America, and their unholy alliance.